Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at two or three subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with New York Times veteran war correspondent Chris Hedges, the author of War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning and What Every Person Should Know About War. And Chris Hedges, as I say, is a veteran war correspondent. He survived ambushes in Central America, imprisonment in Sudan, and a beating by Saudi military police. He has seen children murdered for sport in Gaza and petty thugs elevated into war heroes in the Balkans. And we'll be talking to Chris Hedges about the war in Iraq and the extent to which it's being compared to the Vietnam quagmire. And we'll also talk with Ivo Dalda, who is the former director of European Affairs at the National Security Council under President Clinton. And he's now a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. We'll be talking to him about the Bush foreign policy and its radical nature in terms of Ivo Dalda's new book, America Unbound, The Bush Revolution in Foreign Policy. And then we'll talk with Toby Dodge, who is a historian who has written a book, Inventing Iraq, The Failure of Nation Building and a History Denied. And Toby Dodge is a senior research fellow at the Center for the Study of Globalization at Warwick University in England. And he was in Iraq in May and June of this year. And we'll talk to him about the history of Iraq in terms of nation building, the failed British attempt in the 20s, and the attempt on the part of President George W. Bush at the moment, which appears to be in trouble. I'm speaking with Chris Hedges, who's a veteran war correspondent. As I mentioned, Chris, you'd survived ambushes in Central America, imprisonment in Sudan, a beating by Saudi military police, and seen children murdered for sport in Gaza, and petty thugs elevated to war heroes in the Balkans. In terms of Iraq, I know that you was recently at a commencement address at a university in the Midwest where you were skeptical, if not critical, of a rush to war, and you're booed. Do you think if you gave that speech today, you'd have a more receptive audience?
I think people have begun to ask the kinds of questions that, as a country, we should have been asking before we got involved in Iraq. You know, unfortunately, those questions are beginning to be asked because of the horrible price that mostly young American kids are paying every single day with this Iraqi occupation.
Well, in terms of the Vietnam quagmire, which is coming up a lot now, I mean, clearly in Vietnam, as long as we were fighting that war, we were losing, effectively fighting a birth rate. But the minute we stopped fighting the war and the Vietnamese had to build their own nation, they became basket cases and they were rattling the tin cup asking for America's aid. So it makes you wonder why we were on that fool's errand for so long. But I don't believe that if in Iraq, as opposed to Vietnam, I don't know that the Iraqis seem to be prepared, ready, or able to build their own nation, given that it's suffered decades of sanctions and decades of looting by a mafia family of thugs who ran it and appears to be broken now. And the question, I guess, is, do you think we can fix it? Or is it too far gone?
Well, I don't think you have to remember the resources available to the Iraqis. I mean, they sit on the second largest oil reserves in the world. And even with the war with Iran, and of course I worked in Iraq and know Iraq quite well, there was quite a healthy or strong middle class. You know, you would go into hospitals, even in remoter parts of Iraq, up in northern Iraq, or, you know, in Erbil and these places. And these were very modern facilities.
Well, Iraq had a higher GDP than Portugal in the 1970s before Saddam took over.
Yes. Well, no, Saddam, of course, was a parasite. But even then, I think we must remember that Iraq is not Afghanistan, that Iraq, you know, there was a large sector of the Iraqi population that was very well educated, that had a professional class, and they had an income to sustain a standard of living that was relatively high, even under Saddam Hussein. And now much, of course, has been destroyed. The sanctions and mismanagement on the part of the old Iraqi regime have certainly devastated the oil sector and most sectors of Iraq. But nevertheless, the resources are there. The oil is there so that Iraq can be rebuilt. Iraq is not in the same situation as a country like Afghanistan that really doesn't have natural resources other than, you know, the export of opium to put itself back together.
And in terms of the soldiers in Iraq, this is obviously the all-volunteer army as opposed to the draft army in Vietnam. But I understand there's certain restiveness amongst the soldiers. Some of them feel that they've been had, that this is a political war that was not adequately explained to them, and that the absence of weapons of mass destruction indicates that there was no clear and present danger to the United States. What's your reading on the extent to which there's a smoldering revolt in the military ranks? There's clearly a smoldering revolt in the intelligence ranks. But give us a sense of what you know about the military.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, you know, we've had indications of that, and there's been reporting on that. But what's particularly troubling is the smoldering revolt. I think it's probably, at this point, outright rebellion on the part of the reserves and the National Guard units. Of the 120,000 or 130,000 troops in Iraq, about 60,000 come from National Guard and Reserve units. And because the administration has really abused that system, most of these people, at least from everything we can tell, certainly a very large percentage, have no intention of reenlisting. So that if we become increasingly bogged down in Iraq, which appears to be happening, and we don't have those pools of reserves and National Guard to draw upon, then, you know, unless there's an increase in sort of those who are willing to volunteer to go into the military, I think, and we can't walk away from Iraq, I think we will begin to look at the possibility of a draft. I think the consequences of this could be severe for the national fabric, because I suspect that, you know, if we reach that point, there would be a great deal of opposition towards the Iraqi policies and toward what's happening there.
Well, this week, President Bush made a major foreign policy announcement where he suggested that 60 years of U.S. relations in the Middle East had, in a sense, turning a blind eye to the political realities, had created this mess, and that by doing what he's doing, he may be breaking the China. But he felt, he's arguing that the situation, the status quo is unacceptable. It's pretty hard to understand exactly whether he's making excuses for the mess that he's created, or whether there is a way to for freedom to triumph over instability. And that this is somehow, we're going through a transitional period. But my understanding of the Middle East is that actually the people in the Middle East hate us a lot more than the governments do. So
if we had
any democracy there, it would seem to me that we'd be actually worse off in terms of...
Well, I think that one of the important things to remember, and I think this is perhaps something that the feedback that the Bush administration is getting from the region, is that we are... reviled in a way that I've not seen in 20 years as a foreign correspondent and many years in the Middle East. And we with this Iraqi invasion and occupation have garnered sweeping condemnation and I think even rage throughout the region. It's one of the reasons you see hundreds, probably thousands, of disenchanted Muslim men descending on Iraq for target practice against, American GIs, with not much protest by governments like Saudi Arabia. I mean, our whole relations with the Saudis, and I'm not, and I think that's another discussion as to, our close ties to the Saudi royal family and how prudent that is over the long run, but there's very little effort at this point to staunch that kind of anger. I mean, we have deeply angered the sort of street, and we have deeply alienated our allies in the region, who are very beleaguered. I mean, if you look at President Mubarak, for instance, I mean, these are increasingly authoritarian states that depend solely on force for control. And because we are so identified with these despotic regimes, coupled with what's happening in Iraq, the situation in the Middle East is not like anything that I've ever seen. And I first moved to Jerusalem in 1988.
Well, I think that obviously going to war was a massive blunder, and it's just a question of how deep we dig the hole and whether we can dig our way out of it. I mean, there's also indications that Karl Rove may well take over foreign policy in the summer if he's not already co-creator of it already. They'll just sort of declare victory at the convention and say the boys and girls will be home by Christmas and wipe their hands of it. But that, again, I just can't. I mean, maybe there's a way that President Bush can blackmail the rest of the world, saying this is a terrible mess and you're going to have to help us out. I just don't see anybody ponying up at the moment.
Well, I think we've done a pretty good job of alienating the rest of the world. I mean, the kinds of things that we did in the buildup to the war, I mean, essentially gutting, the NATO, gutting the UN, ensured that we wouldn't have any friends once we sort of walked into, this mess. And there'd have to be, we have to rebuild what, in essence, we've destroyed. Whether they're capable of doing that, I don't know. I mean, at this point, it's pretty clear that nobody, and for quite obvious reasons, wants to send their troops into Iraq. It's virtually, at this point, a British and American enterprise with, a couple thousand troops from Poland and a few other places. And that's not going to change. Now, what's going to happen if this continues? I mean, if you look at the numbers month by month, and, of course, the last week has just been, horrific. If these things continue, you're right. I mean, I think the only thing that might save the Bush administration, which we must remember is a distinct possibility at some point in the future, is another catastrophic terrorist attack on American soil. And that might be enough to sort of divert attention away from Iraq and, again, push people towards sort of clamoring for more, more sort of security measures. So
in other words, you think the American public are too far gone, that they bought this jingoism, that they can't see the forest for the trees? If we have another al-Qaeda attack, then that would seem to a logical mind to say, well, hello, that's the unfinished war that we're supposed to be fighting, and we got distracted with this unnecessary and unwinnable war in Iraq, and now we've had a wake-up call, and we should throw these incompetents out who have recklessly endangered the security of the United States.
Well, I think you have to look at Israel. I mean, I think that when people are as frightened as you can be, I mean, as the Israelis, for instance, are, and with the spate of suicide bombings that sort of shook the country, people just clamor for, just sort of stomp the vermin out. And then the most sort of pernicious and violent elements within the political system, one thinks of Ariel Sharon, who promised to do that, are elevated. And I worry, and especially, being in New York after 9/11, that we could wrap ourselves in the flag, wrap ourselves in that kind of self-righteousness, and storm out and try and sort of lash out in a way that could be even more self-destructive than what we're doing now. I'm not completely convinced that in the event of terrorist strikes on American soil, people are going to back off and be rational about it. I certainly think that's not the case in Israel, because the sending F-16s into Khan Yunis and Rafah and these kinds of places is only dumping gasoline on the conflict. But at that point, people stop thinking on both sides.
Mm. Well, Chris Hedges, again, let me remind the audience, I'm speaking with Chris Hedges, who's a veteran war correspondent for the New York Times and the author of War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning and What Every Person Should Know About War. And clearly, war is an incredibly serious business, and it shouldn't be entered into lightly. And it, at least to my mind, it has been entered into for reasons that were never explained in this Iraq war. And that may have more to do with something that George Bush personally feels he has to prove. I just don't understand how the professionals in men could have allowed this to happen. Is it because the political opposition have folded? Or what about institutional opposition?
Well, I think the political opposition, I mean, let's be clear, it wasn't just the political opposition that folded, but the mainstream media folded as well. The Democrats never made this an issue during the campaign, with very few exceptions, Wellstone and a couple others.
We've got Dennis Kucinich on later in the second hour.
Yeah, well, he's one of the few who stood up and questioned this, asked the right questions, in my mind. And the press itself, with very few exceptions, there was very little questioning of the dubious and frankly mendacious intelligence that was used to justify this. I mean, you had Walter Pincus on the Washington Post, a reporter that has covered the intelligence community for 25 years, writing, with obviously very good sources, saying we don't think there are weapons of mass destruction. We don't believe that he's reconstituting his nuclear program. There are no links to Al-Qaeda. But this stuff was buried in the Post, very rarely put on the front page, and sometimes didn't get in the paper at all. I don't think anyone at the New York Times was doing that. And then beyond the Times and the Post, everyone just sort of rolled over and played dead on this, and I'm not exactly sure why. So there was a terrible failing, both by the political opposition and by the media. And you can't fault totally the American public for sort of going along with this, because it is the job of the press to raise those questions and do that kind of investigative journalism. And it wasn't done. It just wasn't done.
Well, just in closing then, Chris Hedges, I don't know how we can get out of this mess, because I don't think you can leave Iraq in the chaos that will inevitably ensue if they just pull out. There's clearly the bad guys are lurking and they want to take over. And so,
Iraq reminds me of Yugoslavia. It is also broken into three very distinct and antagonistic, essentially ethnic groups, the Kurds, the Shiites, and the Sunnis. And at this point, if we walk away, I suspect that it could resemble the Yugoslav War. The only solution is, of course, to end the American occupation, to build, under UN auspices, a real international peacekeeping force that has enough muscle in it to stop these factions from tearing each other apart, and try and begin that long, slow transition to rebuilding a country and stopping the kind of violence. I'm not sure that at this point, you could find enough support among member nations to do that.
Well, clearly there isn't, because then nobody's ponying up. In fact, the UN is drawing down.
Right, but they're drawing down because essentially it's an American-led operation.
Right.
At that point, I mean, the only way to do it is essentially for the United States no longer to try and occupy the country, but turn it over to a real international force. But I don't see anything beside that, and I'm not even sure that that's going to work.
Well, I don't think that the rest of the world feels that Bush is giving them the back of the hand, and they're probably happy to see him twist in the wind.
They're right, and that is part of the problem. We have dug ourselves into a very, very deep hole.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Chris Hedges.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with the veteran New York Times war correspondent Chris Hedges, the author of War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning and What Every Person Should Know About War. Let's now go to the issue of the broader analysis of this radical new foreign policy conducted by George W. Bush. I'm speaking with Ivo Dalda, the author of America Unbound, The Bush Revolution in Foreign Policy. And Ivo Dalda is a senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution, and he served on the National Security Council as the Director of European Affairs during the Clinton administration. And Ivo Dalda, clearly we are in trouble in Iraq. And many, in fact, I've spoken to a number of people prior to the war suggesting that people who had actually spent time in Iraq, and it seems that the people who actually knew about the country weren't consulted, but the long and the short of it is, they said this could be a quick victory followed by a slow defeat. Now, beginning to look like a quick victory followed by a quick defeat, does this have the potential or the portent of a major foreign policy disaster?
Yes, it very much does. I mean, clearly what we're seeing in Iraq are things going okay in certain parts of the country, as we're being told in the south, the Shia is still very happy about the fact that Saddam, who made life truly miserable for them, has now disappeared. And in the north, the Kurds, who had been independent, frankly, under the under Saddam, remain virtually independent. But in the center of the country, we are confronting what is a counterinsurgency, what General Abizaid, the head of CENTCOM, has called a guerrilla war. Guerrilla wars, particularly when they move from just a few bad apples taking pot shots at Americans to getting the kind of public support that you're seeing in certain cities already, and increasingly perhaps even in Baghdad, those kinds of guerrilla wars are things that the major powers like the United States tend to lose.
And indeed, the people that the traditional allies like the French and the Germans, who were castigated and to some extent vilified as being cowards and not supporting the United States, many of their objections were based upon the reality that is now biting the administration.
Clearly, many people who opposed the war were fearful about two things. One, that the chaos that would emerge in the aftermath of a war and the ouster of Saddam Hussein would attract more terrorists, would become a magnet, really, for the kinds of people that we're now seeing in one way or another streaming into the country in order to take the war again against us in the way that we are seeing that happening. That's happened. Terrorism now is rampant throughout parts of this country, and as the president keeps on saying, the central front in the war on terror is Baghdad. Well, it is so in part because we've made it so. So that was one criticism. The other one we don't quite know yet. It's a little early day on this one, which was the notion that if you intervened in Iraq, the entire Arab world would explode, that the Arab street would go crazy, that much of what would happen in the Arab world and the Muslim world would be highly negative, not just for the United States, but for the Western world in general. We haven't seen that. At least overtly. We don't know what is going on in the minds, collective and otherwise, that is of the Arab people. Clearly, they're not happy about what is happening in Iraq. On the other hand, they're not terribly unhappy about the removal of Saddam Hussein.
Well, last week I spoke with Graham Fuller, who's one of the few foreign policy experts who actually speaks Arabic, and he often appears on Al Jazeera as a private citizen arguing the American case, which he finds increasingly difficult. But he pointed out that he thought that we could actually find ourselves quite soon in the situations the Soviets were in Afghanistan, where we become the object of a global jihad. And already there is evidence in the New York Times the other day that the mosques in Germany and France, young men are disappearing off to Iraq. So if we get into this situation, at the end of the day, I guess the questions you ask is, well, this is George W. Bush's war. He got us into it. If you don't like him, you may want to see him twist in the wind. But what about America and America's place in the Middle East?
Well, that's one of the big issues that is now confronting us, frankly. Is there a way for this president to rescue the situation, short of running turning tail in a way that will not help very much either? One, it won't help the people in Iraq. And more importantly, if we are chased out of Iraq, as we were chased out of Lebanon and chased out of Somalia, that too, we have now learned, encourages the terrorists and the jihadists to come after us. So that's the fundamental dilemma. The problem we have had is that the revolutionary, radical foreign policy that this administration has pursued, where it basically has decided that international institutions, allies and friends and alliances are constraints rather than aids to our power, that having abandoned allies, having gone it alone, we are now all by ourselves. The fundamental reason we are maybe approaching the same situation the Soviet Union was in Afghanistan is because the American face of the occupation is generating the opposition. It is generating the loss of consent among the Iraqi people to our continued presence there. Even as they are happy about Saddam Hussein having been kicked out of power, as this administration rightly points out at all times, they are also unhappy about the fact that their lives are now determined by an American occupation that seems to be unable to provide them with even the basic security that they need so that schoolgirls can go to school without fear of them being abducted and raped, that their businesses can continue to go on without fear that they be looted or that there is any theft of their money or their goods, none of which is happening at the moment. So the problem we now face is that the administration has to confront the fundamental dilemma that Howard got us into this place is creating the deep hole in which we're falling, and that the only way out of it, frankly, is not to withdraw, but to bring in other people, to bring in the United Nations, to bring in as much international support, to internationalize the occupation to the maximum extent possible, so we can help the Iraqi people stand back on their own feet.
Well, that's not happening, though. I mean, the people that the administration gave the back of the hand to are the Germans, for example, are helping out in Afghanistan. I can't see anybody in the United Nations jumping in. In fact, the United Nations actually just bailed out. It does seem like a deepening hole there, and I know that this is a very politically driven administration, and I imagine come next summer Karl Rove's going to be taking over foreign policy, and if this is a millstone around their neck, I'm not sure that they're not cynical enough to just declare victory and get out. But At this point, I fail to see that we can leave this place in better shape than we got it into, and it just seems extraordinary that this could have happened. But I guess the answer is pretty clear. This happened because there was no opposition in the government, in the press. There was no public debate. They gave specious and often contradictory reasons for going into war, and now we're finding out they lied.
No, there's no doubt that the kind of debate that we had and the politics of this administration, and if you think cynically, quite brilliantly played by having the Democrats, forcing them to vote on the question of the war just 2 weeks before the congressional elections, which, by the way, they lost in any case. They played it brilliantly. They put the opposition on the side. They basically made the argument that the weapons of mass destruction were there, using much of the information that was around in the Clinton administration. So they didn't even have to hype much of it, though they did at times hype a lot of it, and marched the country off to war. I mean, one of the things that is remarkable about this president, who has generally been looked at as a foreign policy lightweight and really not in charge of his own administration, is that he's turned out to be a rather confident, bold, and decisive leader. He's led us in the wrong direction, no doubt, but he has led us with great skill and certitude. He decided that he wanted to go after Iraq. Nothing was going to stop him. There was not an opposition here in the United States or any opposition abroad that was going to prevent him from doing what he wanted to do. And in fact, there was sufficient support within the United States to enable him to do that. What he may do now, though, and I think one of the things we have to be aware of, is that he may cut his losses in a way that is politically acceptable, not by cutting and running and deciding that maybe what we need to do is to do another Lebanon or another Somalia, but to turning this into another Afghanistan, where fundamentally the American military presence would be geared at counterinsurgency that is going after the Ba'athist and what Don Rumsfeld calls the dead-enders of this regime, and the terrorists who have been flocking into the country, and giving more and more, if not all of the power, to the Iraqis. The Iraqification, the same word we used in Vietnam, by the way, when we talked about the Vietnamization strategy that we are now seeing emerging.
So we'd have the same situation as Karzai hold up in Kabul. We'll have Chalabi hold up in the palace.
Well, whether it's Chalabi or somebody else, I think the big difference between an Iraq where you try to impose the strategy, which will reduce the number of casualties that we see on a daily basis, and the one we have in Afghanistan, is that much of the terrorists will be waging war against the Iraqi population as well, because that is how you generate opposition to the occupation. That, in fact, the kind of bombings that we saw in the last few weeks, and actually months now, against the UN and police stations and against so-called collaborators, will intensify, and it will be very difficult for the United States, under those circumstances, to remain as they are in Afghanistan, focused on the counterterrorism and counterinsurgency operation, when much of the city of Baghdad, for example, is falling apart. Because even if we can get 200,000 police and security forces, train them a couple of weeks and give them a gun, these people are unlikely to be able to prevent the looting. They are unlikely to be able to provide the security for installations against terrorist and suicide bombing attacks. And under those circumstances, what we are most likely to see is the kind of chaos that feeds the terrorist instinct, and in some ways that will make this the foreign policy disaster that it now seems to be coming.
Well, indeed. I mean, some of the police, they will find that their own children are amongst the insurgents, because you have to ask yourself, who are all these young kids you see cheering beside burning American vehicles? Let me again remind the audience, if I may. I'm speaking with Ivo Dalder, who's the author of America Unbound, The Bush Revolution in Foreign Policy. And Ivo Dalder is a senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. He formerly served on the National Security Council under President Clinton as the director of the European Affairs. And talk about the broad sweeps, as which you do in America Unbound, and try and get a handle on this radical and revolutionary president that we have in terms of foreign policy, and indeed in terms of domestic policy. This is not your traditional conservative. His core support is the religious fundamentalists and big business in terms of media, energy, mining, etc. This is not the Chamber of Commerce type of Republican that the party used to traditionally represent. But there is also this strange combination, and it's actually a contradictory combination of unilateralism and isolationism. Going back to 9/11, which sort of has defined this presidency, because he really was on the ropes prior to that, or at least he wasn't. He spent most of his time talking to schoolchildren rather than facing the nation. Obviously, it would have been better had, 9/12, 9/13, had he convened a meeting in New York, where, after all, the United Nations is headquartered, and formed a global coalition against terror at the time when Le Monde was saying, "Nous sommes tous, we're all Americans," That so I often wonder whether this is really about that he really is more of a domestic politician. He's on the world stage, but his instincts and his decisions are entirely about him and about America and about his vision of America rather than about the world. And I know that in many ways you've made a strong case for that, but basically that's my real question is whether or not this is a foreign policy that serves domestic ends. In other words, is this really the Karl Rove foreign policy or the Bush Rove foreign policy?
Well, and to some extent, all presidents act abroad and at home in ways that they think advance the national interest and happens to happily coincide with their electoral interest. So there is no doubt that making a distinction between what is good politically and what is good for the nation is very difficult to do, no less for this president than for anybody else. I think on certain occasions, this president has demonstrated a keen interest in advancing his own political cause, even if it didn't necessarily advance the national interest. The most hideous example, frankly, is his whole approach to Homeland Security, where he has gone on a two-track policy. On the one hand, pushed for a greater powers for the law enforcement community at the expense of the civil liberties of Americans, to the point that we now have two Americans locked up in a military base without being charged, without any representation, without any of the rights that all Americans thought they had when they read the Constitution, those who had read the Constitution and even those who didn't. But the second one was this notion that we should build a Department of Homeland Security, a massive 170,000 person department, the third largest department in the U.S. government, in which, quite cynically, this administration decided to basically stalemate the Democrats by saying, we are more in favor of Homeland Security than you are, by having a bigger department. And by the way, in the meantime, we're going to take all the union rights away of the people who work there, in the hope that you, Democrats, would then oppose my proposal for improving America's security, the Department of Homeland Security. And it worked, frankly. The Democrats weren't willing to sell out the unions, or indeed the people who were represented by the unions before the election. And the President of the United States went around the country, arguing that the Senate was not interested in securing America, but was interested in a special interest that it represented, to the point, frankly, that it questioned the patriotism of a man who lost three of his limbs in the Vietnam War, Max Cleland, the senator in Georgia, who was defeated as a result of such cynical politics. So, yes, we see a lot of cynical politics in this presidency. On the other hand, in the way that I look at this president and his foreign policy is that while he came in as a domestic political president and wasn't focused on foreign policy, he had certain ideas about how the American should engage in the world. Most importantly, that it should use its power to get its way. And what 9/11 did is it provided him with the opportunity to act on what you might call the means and motives of his foreign policy, that ultimately he was now able to pursue his policy to its logical conclusion, which I think we're seeing today in Iraq.
Well, it's still when you look at the results, it does seem in many ways counterintuitive, and again, you know, this sort of, he's alternatively pugnacious and petulant, and you've got. I mean, for example, my daughter, can't travel I'm nervous about her traveling abroad. You know, I mean, what kind of national security do you have when Americans are vilified, hated by their former friends, their enemies are more and more emboldened and growing in numbers. I don't get it. I don't see how this exercise in his sort of personal bravado, if you will, has served the interests of this country. I mean, and also 9/11, as I said earlier, had there been some kind of consensus and an international effort at the time when it was most needed, and the problem was internationalized, then I think we wouldn't be in any of these problems. But the fact that it's never been internationalized indicates to me that that again this is somebody that's or somebody that's acting out, and the rest of us are letting him do it.
Well, I think what you're seeing is a president who did emerge in the wake of 9/11, which is a major shock to the national system, as someone with an answer, and frankly, with a very simple answer, which was, we saw evil people doing evil things to the United States. We saw it on national television. We saw it before our very eyes. And in that shock, it was easy to believe that there were good people, which is the United States and its friends, but primarily the United States, and evil people who want to do us ill. And he provided an expression for the basic rage and fear, really, that Americans felt that day, by going out and killing evil people, frankly, which is what this is about. It's going out in Afghanistan and toppling a truly evil regime. It is going out after Al-Qaeda and the kinds of people who did what we saw on September 11, 2001. And in that quite simplistic way, was responsive to a need that many in Americans were seeking. The problem, I think, as you rightly said, is that it is a little simplistic to believe, one, that you don't have to look at the causes of evil, about why it is that people do these kinds of things. And secondly, and most importantly, why it is you don't try to maximize your power by having more people come and join you in this very important and central fight that we're confronting. This president has abandoned what for 60 years has been the mainstay of American foreign policy, which is that you work in partnership with your friends and allies on the basis, through international institutions, and on the basis of agreed international rules and norms, because that, they argued, those the presidents, Republican and Democrat, his own father being one of the great examples of it, they believed that multiplied our power. It made us more able and efficient to get the things done that we needed to get done. And what he has done instead is he's rejected allies, he's rejected institutions, he's rejected international law as constraints on American power. And as a result, frankly, we now face a United States with less respect in the world, with more people angry at it, and therefore less willing to help us. They're not coming to Iraq for a very simple reason, because not only because we think we were wrong in Iraq, but because the way this president treated them. If you start comparing Germany, an ally that has contributed billions and billions of dollars in international aid and is working in Afghanistan with thousands of troops, to a country like Cuba or Libya, as Don Rumsfeld did, if you start talking about punishing those allies you disagree with, it isn't surprising that they're not going to help you. It's not surprising that they're not going to be out there and do the things that you need to do. And that's the essence of this foreign policy, which is why it's not working. We're losing respect and we're losing our friends.
Well, it's still, there's a surreal quality to it. A lunatic Middle Eastern cave-dwelling serial killer changes the entire political landscape of the United States. And now, and as a result of this horrible thing that he did, this president has been able to suddenly go from, zero in the polls to being a Churchillian figure. He's able to put through his extraordinarily aggressive domestic agenda. He had, none of this was he was elected for. He was barely elected. In fact, it was a rather dubious election, to say the least. This is what troubles me, is that none of this stuff has ever been contextualized. He never contextualized bin Laden as this sort of minus psychotic figure, like a Jim Jones or the guy in Waco. Instead, they made him this great figure. They've talked about a war on terrorism. The other day, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs was talking about the war on terrorism as though it was the greatest threat facing this country. Well, hello? This country got through 40 years of having nuclear-tipped missiles pointed at it round the clock on a hair trigger. If that wasn't, there's no contextualizing the real threats and dangers. And I get this terrible feeling that they're exploiting paranoia, that they're exploiting some of the worst instincts. Instead of us being the victims, we're the victimizers. I don't know how this happened.
Well, I think you put your hand on this earlier. We don't have an opposition. We now have an opportunity in the next 12 months to create an alternative vision, an alternative strategy, and an alternative means, which has to start with the costs of this kind of foreign policy directly in Iraq, where we're suffering 95% of the casualties, we're providing 90% of the troops, and some 80 to 90% of the money. And as a result of that, having a criticism of that, that's what you do, where you get when you pursue a policy like this, begin to contextualize. Remind people that foreign policy is more than a war on Osama bin Laden or in Saddam Hussein, that it also involves dealing with climate change, which is going to kill more people or dislocate more people than terrorism ever will, that we are facing a World War III when it comes to AIDS and HIV. 8,000 people are every day infected with this deadly disease, and to think about how enhancing prosperity for those people who don't have as much as we do, so they don't even get tax cuts because they don't have money to pay taxes, frankly, and to start talking about a very different foreign policy agenda, which at its core has the notion, to regain the notion, that America cannot lead in this world unless it is respected. And the only way it will ever be respected is, to quote one former presidential candidate, it can only be if it is a humble nation. If it is a nation that is not an arrogant nation, but a humble nation, then it will be respected. Unfortunately, that candidate, George W. Bush, has never, since the day he became president, followed his own words when it came to that.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles. Ivo Dalda.
My pleasure.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was speaking then with Ivo Dalda, who is a senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution, and he was the head of the European desk of the National Security Council under President Clinton. I'm now speaking with Toby Dodge, the author of Inventing Iraq, The Failure of Nation Building and A History Denied. And Toby Dodge is a senior research fellow at the Center for the Study of Globalization at the University of Warwick in England. And he was in Iraq in May and June of this year. And I guess the two points that you're making come out of the subtitle of your book, new book, Inventing Iraq, The Failure of Nation Building and A History Denied, the failure of nation building being the British experience and a history denied being our political authorities denying history. Is that in it a nutshell?
Yeah, broadly, I think the thing to stress with the continuing bad news and heavy casualties coming out of Iraq is that we've been here before. In 1914, the British invaded Iraq, swept up to Baghdad in 1917, claiming that they were liberating the Iraqis, they were going to give them a liberal democratic state. But by 1920, they faced a massive rebellion concerning 131,000 Iraqi tribespeople trying to drive the British out. So, and the British government of Lloyd George and Winston Churchill lost the next election on that was fought because the British population thought imperial interests had been overreached, that Lloyd George and Winston Churchill were jingoistic. And so the incoming government had to downscale its commitment to Iraq because of electoral politics and build the state on the cheap. So the result of all that, I think, was a very unstable, unsustainable state that has haunted the lives of ordinary Iraqis and wider Middle East politics right up until today.
And, of course, a British army disappeared, as did another British army in Afghanistan, the other place. So do you think that our America's boys and girls are just going to get swallowed up?
I'm not sure. I think there is worrying indications that electoral politics in Washington are now dictating the policy in Baghdad, that Paul Bremer seems not to have the president's ear anymore and is making policy on the basis of what will play well in the press back here and not what will do best for the Iraqis there.
Well, tell me, though, given that the British failed and in terms of building a nation and that, of course, prior to the British, the Turks held it, for something like 800 years?
That's right, yeah.
Their efforts failed, and then, of course, Saddam took over about 30 years ago and essentially was a kind of mafia thug who ruled through cronyism, brutality, and essentially looted the place. And not only, and of course, he conducted two wars, one against Iran that our side encouraged him to do and helped him to, and then his own little adventure in Kuwait, which we all know about and how that worked out. And now the U.S. is in there trying to build a nation. Well, was it ever a nation? I mean, and at what point are Iraqis responsible? Because it says everybody, of course, particularly on the political left, blames America for everything in the world. But I guess there are limits to responsibility. Where do the Iraqi people come into this? And why is there an assumption that there is a nation to be built here?
I think there is a nation in existence already. What we need to do is build a state. Clearly, Saddam was a thug. He was a tyrant. But in fighting the long war against Iran from 1980 to 88, he called upon the Iraqi population to back him, and they did generally. I think there's a very strong nationalism, certainly in the south and center of the country, forged through the war with Iran, although Saddam was a tyrant and a thug, he did pump a lot of money into infrastructure, into education, into health services. And I think, like across the rest of the Middle East, you know, if you build a state and it stays there long enough, people turn their allegiances towards it. So there is a nationalism there, I think, and what needs to be done is that nationalism needs to be harnessed from the grassroots up and channeled through state institutions which don't exist at the moment. I think secondly, the question is a good one and one that's haunting international relations at the moment, at what stage can the Iraqis take over? Now, the other legacy that Saddam left was a society that's totally fractured. Through the 30 years of his rule since 79, he went into society and viciously broke any organized group within civil society. So the Iraqi population is highly atomized and very traumatized. So to kind of throw democracy at them now or to throw governing institutions at them now at the national level is going to be almost impossible. I think there has to be an international force there to hold the ring to allow democracy to evolve over the medium term. I think we're talking about 10 years. And the only way that can be done is by building at the local level, giving Iraq his local democracy, allowing them to elect people to run what really matters to them, local services, local law and order, electricity, water, and then if these guys don't work, haul them back down again. I think the great danger and the great worry is that in trying to stand up a sovereign authority and trying to get some a group in Baghdad that the Americans can point to and say to the United Nations and the regional powers, look, these guys are running the country, they've actually empowered a group of opportunists that have no echo, no sympathy in the wider country.
Mm-hmm. Kind of carpetbaggers, really.
Well, that's certainly the that's certainly the way they're described by when I was there in May and June. I was very intrigued to see how ordinary Iraqis are looking towards the governing council, and they treat it with contempt and a great deal of anger. Who are these, majority of which are exiles? Who are they to speak to us? Who are they to talk to us? We've been here suffering under Saddam and sanctions for 10 years, 12 years, and these guys waltz in on the back of American tanks and claim to be the new government. So I think that the problem is in setting up the governing council with UN backing at the time, Paul Bremer has actually further alienated the state and the occupation from ordinary Iraqis, which is a great pity.
Toby Dodge, I've had some conversations with some of the intelligence people who say that as bad as things are now in the so-called Sunni triangle, the other shoe hasn't dropped in terms of the Shia in the south. There's clearly the young Shia cleric who is basically taunting the U.S. and so far the U.S. hasn't taken the bait or haven't arrested him, which would probably provoke a major military engagement and perhaps spin out of control. So you just got through saying that Saddam was able to galvanize nationalism against Iran in the long war, that we obviously, Henry Kissinger once said, it's a pity that both sides can't lose. So we had a pretty cynical hand in helping Saddam, perhaps encouraging him to go in there in the first place to punish Iran. But what's going on here in the South? If nationalism was the glue that held Iraq together in its war against Iran, why is there an assumption that the Shia in the South are agents of Iran?
Good question. I think there's a lot of kind of simplistic punditry circulating around at the moment. I mean, again, that's understandable. Very few academics managed to get into Iraq before this year. But those of us who did, if you travel through Iraq, you do find a tenacious nationalism, but also you find people with varying different identities. So much the same as anywhere else around the world. So if you were to be in the South talking to Shias, you'd find individuals who were nationalistic, who were Shia, but were many other things. They'd have identity to do with their town, their profession, their outlook on life. Now, about the other shoe waiting to drop, certainly Muqtada al-Sadr and his Mahdi army are very well organized. He's recruited from the kind of poorest of the poor, the people in al-Thawra, the 2 million people in a big slum on the edge of Baghdad. So he's recruited from those with very little to lose. I don't think he is the popular voice of Shiism, and I think he may well be a kind of passing phenomenon. But you're right, the Americans don't really know what to do with him. They don't have the troops or the intelligence to roll up his organization, and I agree they shouldn't, I don't think. But they also haven't brought him into government, so he can sit on the edge of government and castigate it, criticize it for all its myriad weaknesses, and say, look at me, you know, I'm untouched by this compromise. So I think when we travel through the South, we see a population that has multiple identities. It's not just a homogenous Shia bloc. It is Iraqi nationalism. And also, if liberation on April the 9th was about anything, it was about liberating those people in the South. So they are biding their time, willing to give the occupation and U.S. forces the benefit of the doubt. So there is resentment, there is suspicion in the South, but it's not as much as in the center. And the violence has been comparatively limited, though that seems to be changing. And what is plaguing people down there at the moment is a kind of rampant criminality that the British, especially in Basra, are trying to get under control. So, yeah, I don't see an immediate threat from the population of the South towards the occupation. Sadr's people may well try and move against the occupation, but I think there'll be a very small minority driven by a kind of wider alienation of that section of the population that have been broken by the last 20 years.
Well, Tabby Dodge, I guess the reason that the US has interests in that part of the world, as did the British before them, have to do with oil. I don't think that's I think that's kind of obvious. And it's an interesting story about the history of oil in the sense that, and I think the Americans public don't seem to be that aware of it, that much of the maneuvering that went on in the post-colonial period in the 20s, 30s through World War II essentially ended up where five of the Seven Sisters are American, and two, one Royal Dutch Shell and the other one BP, are British and Dutch. But essentially, the Americans snookered the British out of their control of Iranian oil through the Mossadegh CIA coup. They were lucky to get Saudi oil because Harry St. John Philby, the father of the famous spy, encouraged the House of Saud to do business with the Americans because he said the Americans will just have commercial interests in relations alone and let you run your place the way you want to, whereas the British will want to have some influence over your domestic affairs and putting the Constitution, et cetera, et cetera. So give us a sense of how this subtext is I mean, I know it's a broad question, but... obviously, people think that we're in there because of the oil. I think that's nonsense because you can't even get the oil out because the place is so unstable.
Mm-hmm.
But it may be the motive.
I think oil dominates the Middle East and Middle East international relations, say from the end of the Second World War up until today. But I think the British were drawn into Iraq in 1920, and the Americans drawn in today for even more important strategic goals. I think after 9/11, the Bush administration looked out at the developing world and saw a potent threat from unstable states or states that had an autonomy that they could flaunt their kind of rebellious nature at them. And they wanted to impose the Bush doctrine, which I don't think has got a great deal to do with democracy. It's more to do with saying to states, look, you can do certain things, but there are clear things you can't do. This kind of rights and responsibilities of sovereignty. You can't have weapons of mass destruction. You can't support terrorism. And you've got to be clear and transparent in your banking and trade details.
Well, also, there was a great inconsistency in that Thursday speech where he singled out Iran and Syria and the Palestinians as being largely a part of the problem, and without realizing, of course, that the Iranians do have democracy. The results may not be very good, but they do. The Palestinians have an elected leader. Syria, of course, is a dreadful country, but... You know, I'm saying that it seems to me he was pretty selective in terms of who the bad guys are.
That's the great problem with democracy. That if you believe in it, then you have to live with the results. Now, if there was a democratic election in Saudi Arabia, for example, the most probably, as far as we can see, the government that it would throw up would be much more radical and much more Islamic and much more anti-American than the present one. So I suspect the. The United States is foreign policy is much more geared towards stability than it is equity or democracy, and that's understandable. That's foreign policy the world over. So in calling for President Bush was only calling for democracy where the regimes in place don't suit what he wants to happen in the world. So it's a powerful rallying cry, but the day he gets up and denounces the House of Saud and calls for their removal is the day when America is truly committed to democracy in the Middle East.
And, of course, the other subtext here, apart from oil, is the Israeli-Palestinian situation, which has gone from bad to worse. And most foreign policy analysts believe that is really that should be the first front and center problem to solve before you have a chance of even tackling these other problems.
Sure, you speak to anyone across the Middle East, any Arab across the Middle East, and you know there are three sources driving their resentment. One is clearly the incompetence and corrupt nature of their own governments. Two is a suspicion of the United States, but three, and central up there, is what they see as the continuing inequity in the treatment of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. This present administration seems very, unlike Bush Sr., I add, seems very unwilling to move in there and act as a truly honest broker and say to the Israelis as well as the Palestinians, look, that you need to compromise to get peace. Now, until they do that, the situation isn't going to be worked out. That's the great pity. There was a lot of rhetoric about the road to Jerusalem leading through Baghdad in the run-up to the war. But it seems tragically that because the occupation is going so badly, you have two poles of instability on either end of the Middle East, one being Baghdad and Iraq, and the other being the Arab-Israeli dispute. Now, yeah. My great fear is if Iraq spins out of control even further, if either the U.S. can't control the situation or because of electoral politics in Washington chooses not to commit to that kind of generation-long attempt at rebuilding the state, then Middle Eastern politics beyond the borders of Iraq are going to become even more violent, even more unstable, as the neighbors to Iraq play into that situation in an attempt to gain advantage. Now, that's the doomsday scenario where Iraq becomes a center for instability, for terrorism and violence that would make Afghanistan and the birth of Al-Qaeda look like a tea party.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Toby Dodge.
Thank you.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Toby Dodge, who's the author of Inventing Iraq, and he was in Iraq in May and June of this year. I thank Mark Maxwell, the engineer, and Lewis Vandenberg for research and production. IanMasters.org, all of the programs are online there.